Mr. Chartle.
May it please the Court. Brian Chartle on behalf of the defendant and appellant Enhanced Recovery Company. We are before the Court today on an interlocutory appeal of a denial of ERC's motion for summary judgment. The questions before the Court relate to the proper interpretation and application of the consent defense in the Telephone Consumer Protection Act.
Does this question come before any other Court of Appeals?
No, Your Honor, not that I'm aware of. ERC requests that this Court reverse the District Court below and enter summary judgment in favor of ERC. Specifically,
so can I say right away, the arguments in your brief, like the arguments in the brief of the amicus curiae, struck me as a very interesting presentation that a lobbyist might make to Congress about the way in which cell phone usage has changed over the last 20 years and issues that may not have been foreseen when Congress created the, actually there have been some a few changes, but when Congress has been working on the structure of this. But I find it awfully hard to understand the term called party to be anybody except the party who has been called and who answers the phone. And I will also suggest that I think maybe your argument about the scope of the consent of the prior assignees doesn't take into account the nature of the ownership that the prior assignees had and the phone number, which was a limited ownership interest, if you will, limited license, really. They're licensed to have that phone number as long as they pay. And certainly in the law of property, somebody can't give more than they ever had. And so I'm not sure that the prior licensees ever had the authority to structure the use of that number beyond the time period that it was given to them by AT&T.
Well, Your Honor, you've touched on several points. I think the background is necessary to understand how we got here today. Certainly,
which background are you talking about? Because
the history of cell phone usage.
Most of us know the history of cell phone usage, and the problem that you have there is that we have a statute, and, you know, sometimes Congress doesn't keep up with the times, and so then it has to amend the statute. But you're asking the court to amend the statute.
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree. I think what we're asking the court to do is interpret the statute with the understanding that the use of cell phones has dramatically changed. And what that term meant back then may not mean the same today.
Well, that can't possibly be right if that's your argument. Yes, well, dead is a doornail. The word means what it means. It means what it means to sophisticated users of the language at the time it was spoken. Living Constitution arguments don't go over all that well in the Supreme Court, and living statute arguments are just dead on arrival. So if that's your argument, it's dead on arrival.
Well, no,
you
Your Honor.
You have different arguments, don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely, Your Honor. And what I would like to do is focus on what does the phrase called party mean. And while I understand Your Honor's point that called party means the actual recipient of the call, that's what the district court ruled below. It's also clear that Congress did not intend to completely ban.
Look, 535 people don't intend anything except to pass the statute. We're supposed to be construing language. It's actually written down, right, signed by the president. We're not construing the contents of people's heads. So you need to address the meaning of the language.
Well, Your Honor, the problem, quite honestly, is that perhaps the phrase called party is not that clear and that people could disagree.
That's one possibility. I've looked through this statute, and it seems to have different meanings within the statute. At least sometimes it seems to mean the person who is paying for the call.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? Now, maybe there's some purchase there, but your basic argument for statutory meaning changes to keep up with the times has been rejected more often than I can think of by the Supreme Court. And it wouldn't apply. Suppose this were a statute that said that if Jones consents to enter his house in order to repossess a TV set, you can enter the house without needing a warrant or anything like that. Right? Think of it as a cognovit note for entering houses. Jones then sells his house to Smith, and the person breaks down Smith's door to try to take away Jones's TV, I think you'd have trespass liability. Right? Well, the question for you is there some reason why the called party provision doesn't operate like the law of trespass would?
Well, Your Honor, I think you're dealing with different issues there, constitutional issues that are much different than what we have at issue here.
Trespass is not constitutional, nor is cognovit notes. Just answer my question.
Well,
don't
try
to change the question.
And I'm not trying to change the question. I'm trying to answer the question to the best of my capabilities. I think the issue is different there because, again, we're dealing with what the phrase called party means. And if I may, Your Honor.
And even if called party means the person paying for the call, in this instance, once the number is reassigned, it's the new person. Because in our country, the holder of the cell phone, I think there's one company that doesn't do it this way, but most companies impose a charge both on placing a call and on receiving a call or a text or whatever else people are doing with their phones. What I don't understand is why this isn't handled in a more contractual way, because it seems to me when AT&T or any other issuer of phone numbers turns an account over to a company like Enhanced Recovery for collection, first of all, AT&T could be asked, is this number still assigned to Riley? Is this number still assigned to Morgan? Because it certainly wasn't at the time AT&T turned it over. Your company could ask for indemnification if AT&T turns over a bad number to you and you wind up in this kind of litigation.
There is no meaningful way to determine who the current owner of the cell phone is.
AT&T issues the phone number to people. It bills them. I assume it's sending the bill to the new users.
Yeah, and Your Honor, we were dealing with a landline here that the debt related to a landline. We have no idea who owned the cell phone.
Reject that. I mean, I know the difference. Believe me, I know the difference between landlines, and I know people who have only cell phones, including all three of my children, and lots of other things like that. But somebody sends a bill associated with a particular telephone number to a recipient, right?
Yes.
And after the number has been reassigned to a new recipient, the new recipient gets the bill, right?
Yes.
And so that's why
AT&T,
exactly, the person to whom that number has now been assigned.
Right.
AT&T knew, as of the time it turned the account over to you, that this phone number was no longer assigned to the deadbeats.
No, Your Honor.
AT&T didn't know?
They would not know.
That's impossible.
Wait
for the question. The reason you got these accounts is that the people hadn't paid their bills. And the thing that happens, phone companies stop providing service to the people.
Related to the landline.
Any line.
This is a number, right? AT&T knows when it turns it over that the person who, the deadbeat, we will call him, no longer is assigned to that number. Now, it may turn out that AT&T doesn't know who is assigned to that number. They may have put it in the world of cell phones, may have transferred it to Verizon or Sprint or somebody else, but AT&T knows one thing. It knows the deadbeat doesn't have his number anymore.
No, Your Honor. If I may, if the court could just indulge me for a second, I'll clarify the confusion. AT&T was not providing service to the cell phones.
AT&T
dealing with the question.
AT&T canceled its service with Dupree Riley
for
and
the
with
landlines.
Sherita. Its service. So AT&T knew that Dupree Riley and Sherita Morgan no longer had an account associated with that number of a landline, of a fax, of a cell phone. That particular set of 10 digits was not actively being used for service for those people because
the
they weren't
number.
Paying their bill. Right. I don't know why you're obsessed with landline. It doesn't make any difference. The fact is AT&T knew that calling that number would not produce the former customer.
I apologize if I'm not answering the court's question, but AT&T was not providing service to the cell phones.
It doesn't matter.
So I don't understand how they would know
you
that service was
understand.
Disconnected to the cell phones when they weren't providing
the
service.
The point is, it's trying to use the cell phone number that was given in association with the landline for...
As a contact number.
For a contact number. But the 2583 number
that was the cell phone number
discontinued.
Your Honor, if I may, AT&T was providing landline service. I don't know which phone company was providing cell phone service to the consumers at that time.
The one thing AT&T knew, and which therefore they could or should have passed on to you, is that the deadbeats no longer had the number at which they had consented to receive calls. Who did have the number, we may not have known.
Your Honor, I, again, maybe I'm failing to recognize the point, but I don't understand how AT&T would know whether or not the cell phone lines were no longer connected when they weren't providing service for those phone lines. AT&T was providing residential landline service. We know that those phone numbers were disconnected. That's why the bill was placed with enhanced recovery. But AT&T was not providing service to the cell phone numbers, the phone numbers that were provided as alternative contact numbers at which the consumers could be reached. How would AT&T, if they're not providing service to those numbers, be aware that the numbers were disconnected? I suppose they could ask every single other cell phone company out there that provides cell phone service, are these numbers...
Your client needed to know, which is whether the deadbeats still had the original numbers. Now, that's the one thing AT&T did know. The answer is no.
Your Honor, I again...
So you're saying there are two phone numbers. I understand that, but...
I don't understand how they would know that, Your Honor.
Why did you tell people just to delete the message so that they would have robocalls in perpetuity?
Your Honor, there are other laws that are in play when debt collectors make calls, for example,
and
the FTC.
I'm just saying, you never told people that they actually had the burden of calling these annoying interrupters of life. You just said, you know, if you're not Dupree Riley, delete this message.
What?
So they delete, and then they get another call. If you're not Dupree Riley, delete this message. They delete, they get another call. If you're not Dupree Riley, delete this message. They delete another call.
Sure. And I'm answering Your Honor's question as to why we would include that in our automated message. It's because there are other laws that are at play here, including the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And that language is included in those automated messages to avoid concerns regarding third-party disclosure. I really want to focus on this issue that I think there's some confusion about, although there are some other arguments I would like to address. But AT&T would not know that these cell phone numbers no longer belonged to the consumers. AT&T was not providing, to my knowledge, Your Honor, was not providing cell phone service.
Your opponent argues that there are a number of easy ways to find out whether a cell phone number is still active.
That's not true. It's simply not true. There are searches.
And what Congress is trying to do is allocate a burden of hassle, I will call it, and take it away from the consumer and put it on the companies.
Well, Your Honor, again, all a consumer has to do is say stop calling.
They can't. There's no person at the other end of the phone. There's a computer.
Well, here,
you can't say stop calling when somebody says delete this message.
It depends upon what type of message is being delivered. Most of these calls...
You can't. I mean, we've all been subject to, you know, annoying message number 1 or 3 or 400.
Your Honor, many of these calls are what's called predictive dialer calls, where if a person on the other end physically answers the call, the call will be routed into a collector. And
you know
then
what? Who would want to answer that? Everybody has caller ID these days. I don't know anybody who doesn't monitor calls, and if it's not from somebody that you know, you don't pick up.
Well, that may be the case, Your Honor, but my point is that there is a way to stop the calls. And, in fact, one
and
of the
so you're allocating the burden of hassle on the consumer.
Why doesn't your client use voice recognition technology to realize when you get routed to the voicemail mailbox? And the mailbox says, hi, this is Sue, and your client is Bill, that there must be a different number here, that numbers must have changed.
Your Honor, and that's why I began by talking about the background of cell phone usage, because the way
this
that it's...
has nothing to do with cell phones.
Well, Your Honor, if I may, many individuals are the users of a telephone number, and they're not the subscriber.
Not very often. I mean, the truth is, with cell phones especially, they are very personal items, and people don't pick up somebody else's cell phone and wait for it to kick over to voicemail.
In any event, I wish you would answer the question I asked. The question I asked is, why doesn't your client use voice recognition technology to pick the name out of the automated response in voicemail?
I'm not sure that that would be effective, Your Honor.
Why not?
That, at least not
Why
completely.
Not? You can't call a customer service operation anywhere without finding voice recognition technology who wants you to choose 15 things on a menu, state your name, recite your account number, and so on. Your client can use the same technology, pick the name out, and discover that it's a different name from the one you're trying to reach.
Well, Your Honor, again, I'm not sure that that technology would be effective in these circumstances, particularly considering the use of various nicknames and the fact that many of these telephone numbers, again, are provided as alternative numbers. And so while I understand Your Honor's point that usually one number is exclusively used by a particular individual, when these phone numbers are being provided on these credit applications as alternative numbers, because remember, here the consumer is going to get landline service from AT&T. Well, give us another phone number in case we need to reach you. Well, I'm going to put as an alternative number my aunt's cell phone number at which you can reach me, or my son's cell phone number at which you can reach me. Well, the consumer doesn't pay the bill for the landline. The bill is eventually sent out to a debt collector. A debt collector's calling that phone number for the consumer, not realizing that it's actually reaching someone different, even though that is a source.
All the more reason why the protection of this statute seems to be necessary to me, because it means you can pester a completely innocent person who never agreed, perhaps, to have to be called ad infinitum, according to you.
Mm-hmm. I have one final question. How do you think this law operates if the person who's giving the consent puts down a completely bogus number? Right? Suppose AT&T says, where can you call me? And the person writes down the number of, you, for example.
Yes.
Right? Is that an effective consent to call you in perpetuity?
No, Your Honor, absolutely not. And we've been very clear in our papers that you can't call someone forever. However, to answer your question, Judge, there would be initial consent to make that first call. But the minute someone says stop,
but you
that
didn't
is how
consent.
A can consent to a call to B. Right? The hypothetical I've just given you, A has written down a different number, a number A has no authority over, and a call is then made to that number. I don't see how A can consent to call B's number any more than A can consent to entry into B's home, or A can consent to the sale of B's dog.
Now, I understand the court's point, but the effect of not interpreting it in the way that we suggest is that you're going to have to stop auto-dialing cell phones altogether. And that is not what Congress intended when it passed the statute.
But then Congress will change the statute. I'm not sure that's the effect. Well, we hear sky is falling arguments all the time. But if Congress thinks auto-dialing is so great, Congress will change the statute.
Well, perhaps and hopefully, but we're left with what we have. And again, I think to respond to the point that Your Honor's made, that could happen and probably often happens where a number is intentionally written down incorrectly or mistakenly transposed, and a number is transposed. And in that instance, if you're going to hold the company liable for making a call in good faith, and we're not just talking about debt collectors, Your Honor, it goes across the board. We're talking about calls from doctor's offices to a patient to advise the patient.
Doctor's offices don't usually robocall, actually.
They use dialers, Your Honor. They definitely use dialers to make these calls, these reminder calls that you have an appointment next week. And if that case, there's going to be liability for such good faith calls, then, again, I think the advice I'm going to have to give my clients is you cannot auto-dial cell phone numbers ever again. And clearly that was not the intent of the statute. And that is eliminating completely any defense.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Edelman.
May it please the court, counsel. The narrow statutory construction argument before the court is the meaning of called party.
And so, Mr. Edelman, will you explain to us why, in your view, the world will not suddenly be free of all auto-dialer calls if you should prevail?
Yes, Your Honor. The parade of horribles that ERC and its amicus come up with are easily dealt with by either a reasonable interpretation of consent or reasonable procedures that a auto dialer should use.
I don't understand. Your brief has got stuff about these reasonable procedures, but your legal theory is as applicable to the first call as it is to the 50th call. And by saying, well, they could adopt reasonable procedures so that if after the first call they discover there's a problem, they do something. But your legal theory is they're legally liable for the first call. So we need to consider that, too.
Yes, Your Honor. One obvious reasonable procedure is to actually have a person place the first call.
But they're legally liable for the first call.
No, if a person dials it, absolutely not.
So the statute applies only to the robocalls.
That is correct, Your Honor. In fact, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which counsel adverted to, sets forth exactly what they're supposed to do if there is an ambiguity as to who that number is now assigned to. It's 15 U.S. Code 1692B. A person, it could be automated and comply, but generally a person calls up and says, hi, I'm Dan Edelman. I am trying to reach Dupre Riley. Is this his phone? If a person answers.
Because it's 227B1 capital A that says using any automatic telephone dialing system or an artificial or pre-recorded
that
voice.
That is correct, Your Honor. If I if I manually punch the numbers or direct a computer to make the call, it is not covered, and a human placed first call, which I think it would be beneficial to the industry as well as to the consumer in terms of rooting out totally misdirected robocalling campaigns, it does not violate the statute.
But that would be much more expensive, one assumes, for the industry. You'd have to go hire all sorts of people to make these first calls.
They normally have very large staffs for that very purpose, because remember, if somebody actually answers the call, it's immediately routed to a live person. So they have hundreds of people in call centers. Sometimes they hire minimum wage people outside the United States, in India or Jamaica, among other places, to handle the call volume, which can now be done. But a manually placed first call does not violate the statute. It's expressly contemplated by the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which recognizes that in many cases contact information is ambiguous, outdated, obsolete, and that it is necessary to acquire location information concerning the debtor.
I'm worried about a slightly different problem, which is the fact that 227 uses call party in different ways. 227B1A, Romanet 3, that refers to a situation in which the call party may be billed, as with pagers and cell phones. So it looks like that subsection is using call party to refer to whoever owns the line and pays the bill. Section 227D3B says the call party's line has to be released within 5 seconds of hanging up the phone. And that sounds like it's using call party to refer to whoever has picked up the phone, because it's the person who hangs up the phone that leads to that release. So we know the statute uses the same phrase in at least two ways. The technical question here is whether it is maybe used in a third way. And your adversary says that the third way is the person we're trying to reach. Now, given that we know it has at least two meanings, what's to prevent a third?
There is nothing in the text of the statute which is consistent with that meaning. The term is always used in connection with the person presently at the number that is dialed.
So by at, do you mean associated with or something? Because at would have to mean at least that if it includes both the person paying the bill and the person who actually picks it up.
It doesn't mean that. If somebody calls my cell number and Judge Wood answers it, the line has to be released within 5 seconds of Judge Wood hanging up, even though she's not associated with my number. Right? So call party means these two things, and they're different things. One of them refers to me. I pay the bills. The other refers to Judge Wood. She answers the phone. The question is whether it can refer to a third person, Judge Flom, who they are trying to reach.
I don't think it can. And I think the answer to the question of what it means in your hypothetical, Your Honor, is that if the phone is assigned to you, you're the called party, and if Judge Wood, with implicit or express permission, picks it up, then whatever consent extends to her. And the protection afforded the called party likewise applies. But in no case does the statute use call party to mean somebody to whom the number was issued 3 to 5 years ago, who no longer has anything whatsoever to do with it. And the interpretation produces...
I've got another technical question. I asked Mr. Chartle whether any other court of appeals had considered this. He said no. Has any court of appeals considered the equivalent question for the junk fax statute? Right? The junk fax statute has potentially the same kind of issue in it.
It's the same statute. It's a different section.
It's a different subsection. So you think it would be the very same question?
It is, and it's also answerable by an intelligent application of consent. If, for example, ERC says in its brief, well, if an employee picks up a fax that's directed toward a business, well, the number is presumably assigned to the business. The business either consented or did not consent, presumably through authorized employees, and whoever the business authorizes to pick up the fax is within its...
The question I'm asking is, many businesses have short lives, so a restaurant consents to an oven manufacturer sending them faxes about new and improved ovens. And they do. The restaurant goes out of business. The number is reassigned to a hardware store. Right? What happens? Express consent has been given to send those faxes.
The question has not arisen before any court in the fax context.
So you think it's not arisen before any court at all, but
that is correct.
Court of appeals.
And I also don't think it's a question which arises in practice. Why? Because if somebody really wants to get consent to send something, to send a fax to a business, what is going to happen is they will call and say, "Is this such and such restaurant? Yes. Do you want information?"
No, they won't call. Right. The consent has been given, either over the phone or in person to the representative of the ovens. It's been expressly given by the restaurant saying, we want these faxes. And you don't, before you send the fax, first call and say, is this still the fax line? That's not the way that works.
Many businesses, do that, and that's been my experience. And nobody would assume that consent...
No one in his right mind would send you a fax, whether you've consented or not.
Your reputation precedes you, Mr.
In terms of handling fax cases, if there's going to be consent, it's normally very contemporaneous with the transmission of the information. Or
so,
it involves membership in an organization.
There doesn't seem in your world to be any room for the good faith mistake. Is that correct?
The FCC expressly rejected it, and it's really not presented by this case because of the substantial list of things which a company in the position of ERC can do to avoid liability. They did none of them. They could have minimized liability by even using, if they had a robocall, a robodialer, they could either through voice recognition technology or by somebody with a pair of earphones determine what the outgoing message was. And once they hear a name totally inconsistent with the one they're trying to reach, they flag the line and go through the 1692B procedure. They can scrub for cellular numbers so that if it was previously...
So how do you do that? You mentioned that repeatedly in your brief, and I wasn't sure what
that
meant.
There are services which do which on a very large volume basis will take a list of numbers, the same that you would feed into an autodialer.
Cell numbers.
Unknown
Any
forms
number.
Of number, and will determine whether the number is issued to a cellular phone or to a landline whatever. In some cases, the exchange and the area code may be sufficient to do that. So you can do that. Even if you're intent on using totally automated systems, the message can be, I'm trying to reach Dupre Riley. If this is not Dupre Riley, press 1 and please advise us of this fact so that you don't get any further calls. Or call this 800 number and tell us. So this is the last call you receive. Lots of companies do that. They didn't.
No, that's going to work for fax. Right? Fax is just a tone. It doesn't include messages like, please call.
Well,
but at the bottom of the piece of paper, it could say, if this is no longer,
if it reached a fax number,
Frank's Restaurant, please let us
most
know.
Most responsible faxers will get an updated list, and normally it's being sent to people that you have a relationship with or have contemporaneous express consent from. Counsel mentioned calls by doctors and medical providers. The FCC has now issued an order in 2012 allowing automated dialing in the case of communications covered by HIPAA, which makes sense because normally if you're expecting medical treatment or you have an ongoing prescription, you're going to give and maintain current contact information with the medical provider. So that makes sense. Here you're dealing with very old numbers. You know that the person wasn't paying the phone bill. You could easily determine whether numbers have been reassigned, in this case to a cell number. You could take a number of steps to determine whether this number has anything whatever to do with the party that you were trying to reach.
So is it possible by paying some service to find out how many times the number ending in 2583 has been reassigned over a given period of time?
I believe it is possible to obtain that information. It is certainly possible to determine whether it is...
I mean, not to whom, but just the fact of reassignment is all.
I believe it is, and you could certainly, for example, if it was previously a landline and is now assigned to a cellular service, you could determine that. Mm-hmm. That at an absolute minimum. So there are a lot of ways to either totally avoid or minimize the problem. ERC almost studiously avoided doing any of these things. And it makes policy arguments which Congress and the FCC have basically resolved in favor of the consumer. The purpose of this statute is to protect current telephone consumers from abuse from businesses using automated dialing equipment. And if by manually placing...
I enjoy the fact that both sides are very confident they know the purpose of the statute. They know the intent of Congress. You just know completely different things about it. And since the intent of Congress is safely locked inside the heads of people who are out of office or deceased, it's hard to contradict any of these assertions.
The text, previous to the passage of this statute, there was no federal regulation of auto dialing. The statute imposed and has revised restrictions on that subject, and I think for the inference from the text of the statute is that it protects the telephone consumer. And the issues have basically been resolved in favor of making the business using the auto dialer takes reasonable precautions to avoid abusing consumers. And just to conclude on the issue of consent, if I manually dial a number, I hear a name other than the person I'm trying to reach, I know that my number is 3 years or 5 years old, I know that I'm trying to reach somebody because they weren't paying a phone bill, I do not have at that point the right to put that number into an auto dialer and have another 10 or 20 calls placed.
Mr. Edelman, what happens on your approach if the debt collector makes the first call in person and says, following Emily Latella, is this the person to whom I am speaking, right? And the person says, yes, I am Jones, right? I'm authorized. You're trying to reach Jones. I am Jones. I'm not paying you. Click. And the day after that, Jones abandons that number, and it's assigned to Smith. Now, your view is the way you avoid liability is to make the first call in person, learn that this number is still assigned to the person who's given consent, and then hook up the auto dialer. So what happens if after the first call the number changes?
The number is not reassigned immediately. Now, under your scenario, if the person says, if the person said in writing, I refuse to pay, they're not entitled to call. Under your scenario, if they want to place...
I didn't have any writing, you know.
Okay. All right. Under your scenario, Your Honor, either the person will call within the period of reassignment, and the estimates are 30 to 90 days, or after that fact. If they call after that fact, the possibility that the number that has been reassigned is self-evident, they should place another manual call. If they call within the reassignment period and the number has been disconnected, they will get a tone and a message which their equipment recognizes that it has been disconnected. So they know there's a problem. And through those technical means, the problem adverted to is avoided. I see my time is up. My remarks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Edelman. Case is taken under advisement.